This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for coming. My talk tonight is called Eating the Book. I could say fasten your seatbelts, but I'd prefer to use the words of William Carlos Williams.
Hold back the edges of your gowns. Ladies, we are going through hell.
These are four books I'm going to talk about this evening. Top left is The Royal Road to the Unconscious. Top right is Rewriting Freud. Bottom left, Getting Inside Jack Kerouac's Head. And bottom right is Pigeon Reader, which just came out in November 2012. The Royal Road to the Unconscious. It's about the unconscious, the irrational, and chance. I'm really fond of this amazing American artist I'm sure you're all very familiar with, Mark Dion, who sadly can't be here tonight because he's in Naples on a piece of artwork, doing some of his work. But Dion's work is really interesting, and he talks about the different relationship the artist has than the academic or the scientist, who may be more interested in the rational, whereas the artist is mainly more interested in the irrational and may be trying to explode meaning. The Royal Road to the Unconscious was conceived in order to conduct an experiment on Professor Sigmund Freud's writing. One night, I was sitting next door when my kids were sleeping in the next room, and I was reading Sigmund Freud's work when I came across this common phrase that's recounted of Freud's: the interpretation of dreams is the royal road to a knowledge of the unconscious activities of the mind. As soon as I hit those words royal and road, it made me think of Ed Ruscha's project, Royal Road Test. I'm not trying to copy or reproduce a Ed Ruscha project. What I'm trying to use is his instructions from Royal Road Test as a ready-made set of instructions to map on to Professor Freud's writing in order to conduct an experiment on his writing. If you're not familiar with Ruscha's Royal Road Test from 1967, this is what it looks like. It looks like a kind of crappy domestic washing machine manual or something. Very cheap and spiral binding. And this was made in 1967. It's about a model royal, the typewriter. This is the fly page. And these instructions are really important. I am going to test you on these, okay? So please pay careful attention. The date was Sunday, August 21st, 1966. If you just remember, it was approximately, if you can hold that, approximately 122 miles southwest of Las Vegas, Nevada. The weather was perfect. The speed was 90 miles per hour. Rob Fiddeman, how was the speed? What speed was it?
90 miles per hour.
Thank you very much, Rob. I didn't plant that either. Brian, whereabouts was it?
Southwest Las Vegas.
Thank you. Approximately 122 miles southwest of Las Vegas, Nevada. This is the car they used. It's a 1963 Buick LeSabre, which kind of looks cool now, but it would probably be just like a very ordinary Ford nowadays. This is Ed Ruscha, the driver of the car. This was the window from which the test was made. This is the test area, and it's known as the Devil's Playground. Now, if you get whacked by the Mafia, I hope you're not, but if you are whacked by the Mafia, this is where they'll put you. And nothing is out there. It's very inhospitable, very, very hot, scorpions, snakes, etc., and a few corpses. Ed is pointing to the point, a little dent in the highway you might notice, in that picture, and the line is showing the distance the wreckage spread. And what he asked his friend, who's standing at the other end of the line, Mason Williams, a writer, is to hurl his royal typewriter out of the car window, travelling at a speed, Rob?
90 miles an hour.
Thanks, Rob. And the rest of the book is just the wreckage. And Don't ask me why. I've got no idea why he did this. And actually, interestingly, I heard recently that they didn't at first even think of documenting the wreckage. They drove 2 miles down the road and then thought, hang on a minute, we should go back and see what happened to the typewriter. This is my favorite moment in the book. This is a tab key stuck in a thistle bush. And this is Ruscha and Mason Williams looking at the skeleton, the corpse of the typewriter. Okay, so this is the Royal Road to the Unconscious in 2003. Again, it looks like a cheap kind of student diary or something with, again, the cheap spiral binding. I'm very inspired by Sol LeWitt, and particularly his sentence number 5, or sentences on conceptual art, where he said, irrational thoughts should be followed absolutely and logically. So if you have a crazy idea, just follow it all the way through. So this is the book we were using, which is Sigmund Freud's celebrated weighty tome, over 700 pages, Interpretation of Dreams. This was my psychoanalyst's copy, in which he stuck a Big Daddy sticker from Sugar Puffs on top of the penguin sticker, the penguin logo. My problem was how to separate the meaning in Professor Freud's work, how to rupture the syntactical certainty of his sentences. And so I thought, of course, of Tristram Tzara's famous experiment in 1927, when he went into a theatre in Paris, and he had a bowler hat with him, and with that bowler hat, he'd cut up his poem, and he literally read words from the bowler hat, randomly, framed. Eberstein. Dream content. Lost. Nephew. The. The. On. 187. Now, you sat there very quietly and didn't make much fuss about my random poem then, but in 1927, the audience went crazy. Some people started to shout at Tristram Tzara for producing this random poem, and friends of Tzara said, shut up, we want to hear the guy do his poem. And then they started hitting the people, and then they picked up chairs and started smashing them over each other's heads. And the actual theatre they were doing this poetry recital in was wrecked. It turned into a massive riot. And afterwards, Tristram Tzara was kicked out of the Surrealist art movement. William Burroughs, talking about this, said that the cut-up was left grounded on the Freudian couch. Sol LeWitt, I would say, provides the permission. Tristram Tzara, I reckon, supplies the method. I'm far too lazy to cut up the whole of Sigmund Freud's work myself, so I got my students to do it. It was a voluntary activity, and I said, just come along if you want to have an experiment next week and bring a pair of scissors. 78 of them turned up, which was quite uncanny because there were 780 pages to work through, so each student got 10 pages each. I can tell you, textile students were the best. They could whip through 10 pages of Freud in 3 hours flat. Chop, chop, chop. Of course, the cut-up references the work of William S. Burroughs and Brian S. Gissin, and particularly their use of the cut-up and the magical potential they saw it having. But statements by Sigmund Freud from 1897 suggestively prefigure Tzara's methodology and leaves open the possibility that it was indeed Freud himself who anticipated the cut-up as a process natural to human thought. Ivan Ward at the Freud Museum in London found this passage. And Professor Craig Dworkin from the University of Utah found this passage. Chop, 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 chop. We tried to use Las Vegas, Nevada as a marker, but unfortunately the Arts Council England wouldn't sponsor us to go there. So we had to choose a different marker. I don't know how many of you know, but Professor Freud escaped from Vienna and the Nazis in 1938 and managed to make it to London with his entire family and his possessions. And the Nazis actually said to him, if you want to leave Vienna, Professor Freud, you'll have to pay a 33% tax on every single one of your possessions. So if the bowler hat was £10, he had to pay £3.33. Luckily for Professor Freud, Marie Bonaparte, his friend, was enormously wealthy, and she said, fine, we'll pay for the lot. So his immediate family and himself were able to get out. He only had a year to live, and his son-in-law, who was an architect, developed the house in Hampstead, London, to the specifications he wanted. And all his possessions, including this famous couch where Anna O recounted her dreams, and the Wolfman, of course, that's there at the house. So we use that as our marker. The time was 7:05 a.m. It was Sunday, June the 1st, 2003. It was approximately 122 miles southwest of Professor Sigmund Freud's psychoanalytical couch. The weather, it was perfect. The speed was 90 miles per hour. This is the car we used. It's a Renault Clio Sport. Va, va, voom. I don't know if you get this sign in the States, but this is the national speed limit in the UK, and it means 60 miles an hour. But I think it may be necessary to transcend the national speed boundary if you're going to access the unconscious mind. This is the psychoanalyst Dr. Howard Britton, who drove the Renault Clio Sport. This is the window from which the test was made. This is the test area, Redbridge Road, crossways in Dorset, approximately 122 miles southwest of Las Vegas, Nevada. This was the moment I released 223,764 words from the window of the car, traveling at a speed of 90 miles per hour. I have to say, it was the funniest thing I've ever done in my life, and I was actually simultaneously laughing and crying. I'm not sure what that means, but it was quite funny. Matthew Collings, the English critic, said, I really think you ought to slow down. This was that fantastic photo that Maurizio Cogliandro, the Italian photojournalist, took of the words traveling at 90 miles an hour. I think it's my Gerhard Richter moment. It made a huge mess, and I didn't want to be accused of littering the public highway, so I cleared up all the words. It takes about 3 hours to clear up that much language. Everything in the unconscious takes about 3 hours. Luckily, I've got a leaf blower that blows and sucks, so I sucked up all the language. I didn't want to just document the words myself or ask the photographers to document them as they felt. If you go into psychoanalysis, Freud's method was to actually sit behind the patient. So you know someone's actually behind you. You've got a presence behind you. They're there, but they're not there. And he used to lean gently forward and just touch them on the forehead. And that was to get them to start to free associate. And people often think when they go to a psychoanalysis that they have to come up with a really good story and tell their analyst about the great weekend they had or whatever. But the analyst is actually not listening to the narrative either. They're listening to what's called the underbelly of speech. They're listening to all the pauses, the breaks, the ums, the ahs, the slippages. That gives them a glimpse of the unconscious. So I asked the psychoanalyst to direct the photographers. I asked the photographers to act as ciphers of indifference and only photograph whatever the psychoanalyst told them to capture. I also asked the psychoanalyst, Dr. Howard Britton, to organize the book, and he organized it into road words and then flora words. I felt this was my tab key moment, tearing stuck in a thistle bush. The psychoanalyst Dr. Howard Britton did point out that dreams aren't always pleasant, and the book ended with fever and night terrors. After 3 hours of cleaning up the language, we found a packet of royals. Since working on the project, after about 6 or 7 years distance from it, I'm able to see it as this simple equation. Sigmund Freud's book, The Interpretation of Dreams, plus Royal Road Test as an interpolation equals 223,704 words traveling at 90 miles an hour. I think you might find the space of presentation interesting because it was presented in three very different spaces. It was presented in a contemporary art space. It was presented in Sigmund Freud's house in Hampstead, in a public museum, and it was also presented in an academic institution, the University of Leeds. So this was the first place, which was a contemporary art space in North Yorkshire. Most of my work involves collaboration. I really like to collaborate, and I also very rarely do the work myself, such as cutting things up or photographing. I did manage to throw the words. So I work with a lot of people, and I really particularly, this resonates for me, Professor Jane Rendall, who's now professor at the Bartlett School of Architecture in London, said I discover parts of myself in my encounters with others. Greville, who owned the space, put this wonderful sign up on the outside of the building, the Royal Road to the Unconscious, and we got no fewer than 10 complaints from the local Richmond Town Council because people were ringing in thinking some weird religious sect had moved into the building. There's so many windows in this space, and I wanted it to be a continuous sequence of images because it's a book and the images you read through in a linear format. So I had to put them very low. And a friend of mine who was a modernist painter, he came to the exhibition, he said, "Simon, this is an exhibition for dogs." So he was, I guess, less than impressed. As you can see, the words are genuinely there. And these are the words that travelled at 90 miles an hour. The space was so huge, we were able to incorporate the car for 2 months. The psychoanalyst generously lent us his car as an exhibit. Ed Ruscha generously joined in from America and sent a copy of Royal Road Test. And then we moved on to the next venue, and we felt there was a problematics of documenting performance art. Although we'd had a lot of fun in Redbridge Road, Crossways in Dorset, when we went down there and threw those words out of the car window, and Maurizio Cogliandro and Daniel Jackson, who filmed the event, faced this maelstrom of non-meaning as these hundreds of thousands of words hit them at speed. Maybe it wasn't so exciting for the spectator, these beautiful images. And I say beautiful, that's no credit to me because I didn't film it or photograph it. But it seems like maybe they were covering over the actual elitary moment, what we call the moment of randomness. So thinking about these problematics when we went down to the Freud Museum, we also got concerned that Professor Freud has an extraordinary collection of art objects. He's got fantastic Greek and Roman art collection, and he also has some Salvador Dali in his collection. Dali apparently was sitting in Paris eating a plate of escargot, and he went, "Ah, I understand the intelligence, the great intelligence of Professor Freud. His head, his cranium is shaped like a snail." So he drew Professor Freud, that's how Dali sounds as well, okay? He drew Professor Freud as a snail. They never showed it to Freud because he was only a year from his death, and they felt the actual ghostless, socketless eyes were so haunting that it would actually terrify him. But we were thinking, you know, we can't put our work next to Dali's, it's going to look ridiculous. So we went back to that modernist paradigm, that modernist theory. Every aspect of the work refers back to itself. We'd thrown the words out of the car window, let's just throw the work into the museum. So we literally threw all the words around in the museum and the framed pictures, which seemed like a good idea at the time. The psychoanalyst suggested we had pools of language as if they were bleeding from the frames. The problem is, particularly people from Brazil are very fond of Professor Freud's work and can sometimes save up for 10 years to come and see Professor Freud's house as it was in 1939. And you can imagine their disappointment when they saw it like this. There was quite a few negative comments. I would like to pay more to see nothing. But what we got was interesting was we got really, really negative comments and really positive comments at the same time. I'd never had that with a piece of art where it was just so yin and yang, it was so back and forth. The Hampstead Gazette actually did a review of it at the time, and they said, don't bother going along to the Freud Museum to see the exhibition, but do go along to see the comments book. It's practically on fire. I did go back a couple of months after the exhibition, and that month of comments had been removed. So I don't know where it's gone, but it's been taken out of the comments book. So again, it was very, very negative and very, very positive. Some people even referred to the language as litter, which I thought was a little bit unfair, because these were all Professor Freud's words, and he had chosen them all by himself. So I was thinking about this, like, really extreme reactions, either very positive or very negative. And it made me think about this wonderful book, I don't know if you've come across it, called Stealing the Mona Lisa, by a brilliant psychoanalyst called Darian Leader, who was also teaching art history at the Royal College of Art in London. And you may be aware that in 1913, the Mona Lisa, the world's most famous painting, was stolen. A house painter walked into the Louvre, cut it out of its frame, rolled it up, stuck it under his arm, and walked straight out the front door. It took them several weeks to realise it was missing, because everyone just assumed it had been taken for cleaning. When they did report it in the press that the Mona Lisa, the world's most famous painting, had been stolen, a massive queue formed around the Louvre to see the missing painting. Now, this may sound kind of weird, and it's like you think, well, maybe this is all the really stupid people who queued up to see nothing. But Franz Kafka was in the queue to see nothing, as was his friend, the artist Max Brod. So what exactly were they looking for? Well, Leder, in his book, he basically suggests that maybe art, the art doesn't actually exist in the object itself. Maybe it exists in the space of transference between the spectator and the work. So therefore, the art can operate even if it isn't there. So this made me think about Andy Warhol's work, and particularly his ambulance disasters from his Death and Disaster series. And this is a particularly gruesome picture that Hal Foster talked about in a very interesting manner. It's a double disaster because, of course, the ambulance has been to a car wreck in the 50s or 60s to pick up the injured victims and then crashed itself on the way back to the hospital. And Hal Foster says in The Return of the Real, he's not so worried about the lifeless corpse hanging out of the top window in the top image, but it's that slippage, that tear, where the ink hasn't actually quite caught the surface of the screen in the bottom image that really upsets him, where the woman's head has literally been torn off. And he felt as if this was what he called a visual pop. Now, what he's referring to, I think he's nicking Roland Barthes's formulation of the punctum, a wound, a tear, a speck, a prick. Somehow the trauma of that event sneaks through in certain points on certain marks on the photograph, and the trauma of the accident wounds you, it touches you. So I'm thinking about that, and that's making me think about Gustav Metzger. Metzger was put on a kindergarten transport by his parents in the Second World War and came to Britain, and has been a stateless refugee ever since. Both his parents were murdered in the Holocaust, and his elder brother, who escaped to Paris, was then caught and also murdered. But after these appalling events for Metzger and his other brother, who were now living in Britain, he became very concerned about the rise of atomic and nuclear weapons. And he sat down in what was known as the Committee of 100 with Bertrand Russell to campaign against the proliferation of nuclear and atomic weapons. And Bertrand Russell actually recounted that one young Jewish man was particularly brave, and he was referring to Gustav Metzger at the time, who was given a six-month prison sentence by the British government for his pains. Well, in 1959, he invented autodestructive art, and he took down three nylon canvases, down to the South Bank in London, and one was black, one was red, one was white, the colours of the constructivist revolution, the colours of political protest. And he covered these canvases with hydrochloric acid. And before very long, you were left looking at absolutely nothing. I'm not so interested for my own work and where it was going in this particular piece, but a piece he did in 1997 in an exhibition in the Pompidou Centre in Paris called Life Live. Again, he had images of the Holocaust, but he said he didn't just want to put them on the wall. So you walked through the room, you had a look at these images, and then maybe you went down to the cafe and had a sticky bun and a cup of tea and said, oh, it's another exhibition about the Holocaust. He doesn't want passive spectators. He wants to activate you as witnesses. So if you wanted to see his work, you had to go underneath the blanket to walk into and literally feel your way across the image. And if you're up against a really, really huge image, underneath a hot blanket, in the dark, feeling your way across, eventually you'd see lots of people looking back at you, all crushed together. And these were Jews who had been packed into cattle wagons on their way to Auschwitz to be gassed. And if you could be bothered to go into, to crawl into, you went actually down on your hands and knees under the blanket and crawled across the floor, you would actually find you were crawling on top of Jews who'd been made to scrub the cobbled streets as a form of humiliation. Critics said this work was particularly poignant because it collapsed the distance between the past and the present as you had to feel your way through the image. So I'm thinking about this and thinking about being in between the blanket, underneath the surface, in between that and the work. And I'm thinking, of course, of Christo and Jean-Claude, who wrap stuff, and they called their methodology revealing through concealing. So for the last presentation at the University of Leeds, we wrapped all 40 framed images, and we poured the words between the glass and the parcel paper. And for the first month, it looked like a minimalist exhibition. And because they're 40 framed, large A1 images, it went right through the fine art lobby, up three floors, staircase, along the cultural studies corridor at the University of Leeds, and back down the back staircase. Samuel Beckett talked about, more and more my language appears to me like a veil that I want to tear apart in order to get at the things or the nothingness behind it. So on the opening night, spectators were invited to recreate the elitary moment, the moment of randomness, for themselves by literally tearing open the images and releasing the words. So once again, the spaces of academia were flooded with Freud. People actually got pieces of Freud in their wine and drank Freud. Little kids seem to enjoy it particularly. I'm available for parties and christenings. This little girl, this is absolutely true, she gathered all this Freud together and she threw it in her daddy's face. What else could you do with Freud? Having never read Freud's seminal work, I now decided it was time to rewrite it. Rewriting Freud was 2005. My wife at the time was an absolutely brilliant, still is a brilliant, computer designer, web designer, creative technologist. And I said to her, I said, can you make me a computer program that will take out every single one of Freud's words and rewrite them in a random order? And she did just that. And this is an interactive touchscreen kiosk. And it basically rewrites Freud's book. All the words are jumbled up and spewed out again. And it takes 78 hours to rewrite Freud's book. Every instantiation will, of course, be different. As it rewrites every page, the spectator is given the choice to print each page, and at the end, you're given the choice to print the whole book, should you wish. So, having rewritten it, I wanted to pour it back into, from the digital, back into the analog to see what it would look like. And at Information as Material, the publishing imprint myself and Nick Thurston and Craig Dworkin run, we're very interested in this concept called undesigning. And undesigning is basically we rip off the design of the source host as much as humanly possible. So the only thing changed there is Sigmund has been changed to rewriting. I take this so seriously, this attention to detail, that even though the book cost me £9,000 to produce, even if I sold the entire edition of 1,000, I still wouldn't make a profit, because I like the joke that it was still at the same price as the 1976 edition that we'd borrowed from at £8.99. And I spent 2 weeks happily in the summer holidays pouring the rewritten language back into the same paragraphs and sentence breaks as in Professor Freud's original. Since then, Christine has made it also into an iPhone app, so you can now rewrite Professor Freud's book with your finger. 2010 is a work called Getting Inside Jack Kerouac's Head. Michel Foucault claimed there was only three original thinkers in the last 200 years: Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, and Friedrich Nietzsche. Sadly, he wasn't probably aware of Steve Jobs, but there we go. What he meant was these were people who created what he called transdiscursive positions. And what he meant by that was they created bodies of knowledge that created further bodies of knowledge. So if you take psychoanalysis as an example, Freud is often credited with having started that, but obviously there are many different forms of it since: Kleinian, Jungian, Lacanian, Freudian, etc. So if there's no hope of being original and the rest of us are merely recycling, I don't find that a depressing idea. I find it very liberating. I kind of think, well, it means you've kind of got permission to do anything you want. Someone else who's very interested in the unoriginal is a fantastic artist. Someone whose work I follow with great interest is Kenneth Goldsmith. And he's really into being uncreative, and his book on uncreativity was published recently by Columbia Press. Well, he went to do a talk at Princeton University, and after the talk, some of the students approached him to have a chat with him, and they were complaining about their teacher at Princeton, their creative writing teacher, who'd give them what they felt was a rather lame task. And the task was, they'd said, go home and imagine you're a really famous writer and write a piece in their style. And well, Kenny said to this girl, he said, well, who did you pretend you were? And she said, well, I sat in my dorm room and I pretended I was Jack Kerouac. She said, but I felt ridiculous. And they felt it was like the kind of thing you might have at high school, but for undergraduates at Princeton, it felt a bit silly. And Kenny said, unless you actually streamed across America in an open-top car, popping pills, downing bourbon, and typing away like a maniac on a typewriter, you're probably not even going to get close. And then his mind wandered to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, where artists go every day to stand there and copy the brushstrokes of the master, supposedly. And if you copy the brushstrokes enough times, apparently you assimilate the brushstrokes of the master, and you will eventually become the master yourself. So he said, if it's good enough for painting, why is it not good enough for writing? What she should have done was copied a chapter of Kerouac's work, and if she'd been really ambitious, copy the entire book. Well, I read this anecdote by Kenneth Goldsmith, and I thought, why not? Let's give it a go. Walter Benjamin also agrees with this. He says that if you really want to get into the soul of a writer, you need to copy their words. He described it as the difference between flying over a country road and seeing how the road weaves through the landscape. But if you really want to experience the road, you have to walk it on foot and to feel every undulation, every bend, and every curve. And he said it's the same for a text. If you really want to experience the text, you need to copy it. So I did it as a blog. It was a purposeful play against Kerouac's original scroll, which had just come out in 2007, which was edited by Howard Cannell. And Kerouac famously typed up his book, 120,000 words, in 21 days flat. He made it into a huge scroll of paper. Apparently tracing paper was stitched together because he didn't even want the addition of each single page to interrupt the flow of his prose. And he hammered out this incredible novel in 21 days flat. And he then rang his publisher and said, I've finished it. And his publisher said, what? He said, I finished on the road. And he said, well, come and show me. So he went across New York and went into his publisher's office and apparently threw the scroll from one end of the room to the other. And his publisher picked it up and said, what the hell am I supposed to do with this? Because he was obviously used to having manuscripts in a normal format. And it took a further 6 years to be changed and edited before it came out in 1957. Well, I'm not very good at typing, so I did a page a day, and I will confess to you that I made a mistake in the very first line. Kerouac starts the book in the original scroll by saying, "I first met Neil." There's a double met. I guess when I proofed it, I probably thought I've put met twice by mistake, so I deleted it. So there you go. Howard Cannell actually said he left the double met in when he printed out the original scroll because it sounded like a car misfiring at the start of a journey. Now, if you pour stuff into a blog, your first post shifts down and then becomes your last post. So having done this, and the nice thing as well is you can have passengers. People could join in on the comments board and take the journey with you. Having finished it, I wanted to see what it would look like back in its analog version. So we made Getting Inside Jack Kerouac's Head. Again, going for the undesigning motif, we did a facsimile copy to the best of our ability. I don't think you have Tesco's over here in the USA, but I think it's the equivalent of Walmart for getting your clothes. We borrowed these clothes from Tesco's and we took them back afterwards and said, "I'm very sorry, they don't fit." I was quite pleased to play Jack Kerouac in this instance, but I had to stand on a bucket because my friend Nick is much taller than me. And that's the back of the book. I don't know if I'm embarrassed or proud of this, but it has inspired some other people to copy Kerouac's work. And this is Joe Hale from the United Kingdom, and he decided to copy Getting Inside Jack Kerouac's Head, which he called Getting Inside Jack Kerouac's Head. The nice thing about copying my version of Kerouac's is he's now obviously put the novel back in the right order. And one of Kenny's students, a fantastic young man, called Jason Jaddick, has done another version, a 24-hour marathon type, which I'm hoping, if this works, you can see here.
In response to Simon Morris's Getting Inside Jack Kerouac's Head, I am going to marathon retype all of Jack Kerouac's The Subterranean Institute.
Don is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, batch out laid off, says he's got a bad call, wants to get it paid off. Took out a pill, it's a...
The name of the long paragraph.
You did, God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway, looking for a new friend. The man in the coonskin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10. Maggie calls Fleetfoot, face full of black soot, talking at the heat, puts plants in the bed, but the phone's tapped anyway.
Does Kenny know about all this?
Yeah. He said if you hipsters are blowing up, the bond of it is higher.
Must bust an early man, orders from the DA. Look out, kid, no matter what.
Yeah, it looks like it gets more spaced out too as it goes on. I just wanted to finish. I'm in the thick of it now, though.
Walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows. Better stay away from those that care out of fire. Keep a clean nose, wash the clean clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Oh, it's
okay. Hey, I honestly feel fine.
Get well, hang around and eat well, hang bell, hard to tell if anything is gonna sell. Try hard, get bought, get back, ride rail, get jail, jump bail, join the army if you fail. Look out, kid, you're gonna get hit by losers, cheaters, six-time users, hanging around the theaters, grilled by the whirlpools, looking for a new fool, don't...
I understand that. I feel...
Yeah. Let me just... Yeah.
I physically can't do it, I will stop. If I think I'm going to hurt myself, I'll stop. But at this point, I think I could physically finish.
Presuming he's not going to watch you actually finish it.
Yeah, but it'll be important. I don't think the project will not be as satisfying to me if it's not finished in one day. And I think I can do it. So I'm just going to go through it.
Follow leaders and watch your parking meters. Oh, get born, keep on, show the pants, roll man. Look out, kid, to keep it all hid. Ready to jump down a manhole, light yourself a candle. Don't wear sandals, try for the scandal. Don't want to be a bum, you better chew gum. The pump don't work, cause the vandals took the handle.
Right? Or three and a half, about three pages left, so. It's been a good ride. Done. 9:58.
Johnny's in the basement, mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement, thinking about the government. A man in a trench coat, badge out, laid off. Says he's got a bag of balls to get paid off. Look out, kid.
I'm pleased to say he has actually poured it back into the analog form, so you can buy Jason Jaddick's version of the Uncreative Subterraneans now. Of course, you'll be aware that the battle is currently being fought between copyright and copyleft, the Creative Commons. There's some great copies out there if you can track them down. This is quite a rare one by Sherry Levine of a short story by Flaubert called A Simple Heart that she produced in 1990 but was only made in a limited edition of 50. There is, of course, Kenneth Goldsmith's own fabulous weighty tome, Day, which is a copy of the New York Times. He spent a year, his 39th year of his life, practicing uncreativity as a creative practice. Copying out the New York Times from the top left to the bottom right. And the more recent one last year is Richard Prince, who's actually done a beautiful facsimile copy of The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger, the first edition. And apparently he took it out into Central Park in New York and put down a blanket and was just handing them out for $50 each. If you were lucky enough to get one. But if you wanted to buy a signed first edition by Richard Prince, it would cost you $59,500 because he's put it at the same price as a signed first edition of the J.D. Salinger. Okay, it's the last book I'm going to present to you this evening, and it's from 2012, and it's called Pigeon Reader. This is inspired by the French novelist Georges Perec, and his wonderful book, Species of Spaces and Other Pieces. Perec's book is particularly beautiful. It was commissioned by an architect, and just give you some idea of what he's talking about from the table of contents. The page, the bed, the bedroom, the apartment building, the street, the neighborhood, the town, the countryside, the country, Europe, the world, space. So a bit like when you write an envelope as a child and you keep going outwards from your home until you've reached the outer edges of the universe. But whoever put this together put some extra short stories in, and one that particularly struck me was a chapter called Reading a Physio-Sociological Outline. And in that, Perec likens the activity of reading to a pigeon pecking at the ground in search of breadcrumbs. So this is the particular piece of text that caught my attention in Perec's novel. like a pigeon pecking at the ground in search of breadcrumbs. So this book, I guess, is asking questions of what does it mean to engage a text physically, looking at print, flipping pages, processing language, vocalizing, responding without any of the social practices or semantics we usually associate with reading. Ed Ruscha, who's acknowledged by a lot of people as being one of the people who started Artist Books in 1962, referred to what he was looking for was a kind of, huh? So when people opened one of his books, they'd be like, huh? What the hell is this thing? I think the contemporary version of what he's saying is this. And I guess that's what I'm looking for in my book. So you have Pigeon Reader. The only difference to Perex is it's called Pigeon Reader, a bit like a critical reader. The penguin has become a pigeon. And as you work your way through the book, at the top, the only difference is it would normally say Penguin, 20th Century Classics, has become I Am, as in Information as Material, publishing imprint, I Am a 21st Century Classic. We've got two sets of bibliographical details here. We've got Perex on the left and my own on the right. And we've got the pigeon and the penguin having a face-off. The rest of the book is a pretty much, as carefully as I could achieve, a facsimile copy of Perec's work. And this follows in the tradition of artists doing inserts into other people's books. You're probably familiar with Rodney Graham's inserts into Dr. No. Well, it's relatively easy to insert something into another book and to copy the standard formula of the page. But my question here was, what would happen if you actually reproduced the entire book just in order to mess with one chapter? So when we get to reading a socio-physiological outline, we have pigeons reading Perec's text. I quite like this page. It's a bit Alfred Hitchcock. These are the pigeons of York, outside York City Art Gallery. After Perec said in his text, reading is like a pigeon pecking at the ground in search of breadcrumbs, the sentence he started immediately after that was, "This image is a little suspect, obviously." And then it goes back to the rest of the book as it was in George Perec's original. At the back, we've had a bit of fun with what we call the paratextual information, where it normally says, "Read more in penguin." It now has "Read like a pigeon." And the back cover, we played some Perecian games as well. My friend, Professor Craig Dworkin, wrote a beautiful blurb. And then I approached Christian Bock, who's an amazing poet, a brilliant performer, and is very celebrated for his book, Eunoia. Well, he came over to London recently and worked with us at the Whitechapel Gallery. And when he was there, we went out for cocktails one evening. And he was playing this game with my wife where you say the name of an animal, like elephant, and the next person has to say the name of an animal beginning with the last letter of the previous word, so tiger, for example. Anyway, he played this for about 5 minutes with my wife, and he said, do you realize I could destroy you at any moment? I could end this game by giving you something that ended with an X, or etc. But he said it's actually fun to play. After a while, it was five of us playing Christian Bock, except we were using our iPhones as well. And he was still winning. And he suddenly said, he just said, "You know, the dictionary is my bitch." So Christian really is an absolute brilliant with language. And one of the things he does is he read the dictionary for 3 years non-stop, back to front, 7.5 million words. So I asked him in a Perecian move to take Craig Dworkin's text, his blurb, and rewrite it using the same words but in a different order. And Professor Anne Wiglin-Delcroix tells me when she received a copy of Pigeon Reader that lecteur pigeon actually means the reader has been conned. Jacques Derrida said you can write almost anything you want as long as you write it in Times New Roman or Arial, font size 12, and you have all your references and your bibliographical details. They don't really care about the content as long as you don't mess with language itself. My psychoanalyst, Dr. Howard Britton, said the exhausting pleasure I find in the book is in the work involved in chewing up its coagulated meaning. I'm thinking of it as a ruminatio. Michael Camille, in his wonderful book, Images on the Edge, talked about how monks used to chew on the words of God. So they used to masticate on them in their mouths in order to release their full flavour and meaning. My psychoanalyst also likened me to this fat little fellow, Per Ubu, from Alfred Jarry's signature drawing, who has this insatiable desire, this ferocious appetite, the gedoil, the oribus on his stomach, as representing an infinity of consumption, which always seeks more. The oribus, the serpent that eats its own tail. So I think maybe why I'm not satisfied with one particular book like Rewriting Freud or The Royal Rise of the Unconscious and just walk away and say I don't need to make any more books is desire is the true meaning of an aesthetic inquiry. If you want a car, when you get a car, you're not the same person as you were when you wanted the car. And Samuel Beckett referred to this as it's like watching your uncle eat a big fat dinner. It's not going to satisfy your own hunger. I don't read books. I eat them. Thank you very much.